Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Barclay against Florida. I think you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I represent the petitioner, Elwood Barclay, who's here on a writ of certiorari to review a judgment of the Supreme Court of Florida, which on direct appeal affirmed his murder conviction and a death sentence. Now, the death sentence was imposed by a judge of the Circuit Court of Duval County who entered written sentencing findings that are the focus of our argument here today. The judge disregarded an advisory jury verdict which recommended that Barclay be given life imprisonment. And the Florida Supreme Court affirmed. Barclay lost by a 4-2 vote, and his rehearing petition was denied by an equally divided court. The petitioner brought the case here on certiorari, and the state filed a brief agreeing that this court should review the case. Now, let me begin my statement of the case before I describe the proceedings in the court below by briefly recounting 5 points about the Florida death sentencing statute. It's the statute that's been in this court before. It was a statute approved in the Proffitt case. And it was presented as having 5 procedural safeguards. First, a requirement that the death sentence be based on specific written findings about aggravating circumstances, which was supposed to serve as a guide for the sentencer's discretion. Second, the statute says that the list of aggravating circumstances is limited to 8 factors, which are listed in the statute. And 6 of those, I'll just refer to in a moment, are involved in this case. Second, the statute provided for an automatic appeal, a review in which the Florida Supreme Court is supposed to keep the sentencing decisions under the statute, in line with the statute. Next, the jury had a special role. Although it's called advisory, the jury's judgment is supposed to prevail under the Florida law unless no reasonable mind could disagree that the death sentence should be imposed. The idea that both the judge and jury will make a judgment both about the sufficiency of the aggravating circumstances to justify a death sentence, as well as a weighing of the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. So in summary, in the Proffitt case, the court said that after a verdict of guilt, there would be what this court referred to as an informed, focused, guided in an objective inquiry into the question of whether a death sentence should be imposed, and that would be at that kind of objective inquiry at both the trial and appellate levels. Now, in Barclay's case, Barclay was found guilty in March of 1975, along with a co-defendant, Duke, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of one Stephen Orlando. And 2 other co-defendants were convicted by the same jury of second-degree murder. After the conviction at the penalty trial, the jury recommended a death sentence for the co-defendant Dugan, but life imprisonment for Barclay. And in the penalty hearing, the state argued for only 1 of the 8 statutory aggravating circumstances, that the crime was heinous, atrocious, and cruel. Yet the state made no effort at that penalty trial to convince the jury that any of the other 7 circumstances apply. And the majority of the jury came back with a written finding that sufficient aggravating circumstances do not exist to justify a death sentence, and a written finding that sufficient mitigating circumstances do exist which outweigh any aggravating circumstances. Now, the judge discharged the jury and directed a pre-sentence investigation report, and a month later entered his own written findings. And 5 years later, in 1980, the judge substantially repeated the findings when he reimposed the sentence after it was first vacated on the basis of Gardner against Florida. And the judge found seven aggravating circumstances. Now let me review some of them. The first one is quoted in our brief at pages 29 and 30. And in this one, it's at the bottom of page 29 and bottom of page 30. In this one, the judge found as an aggravating circumstance that Barclay had some prior arrests and he had a prior conviction for forgery and for breaking and entering. Now, it's acknowledged by the state that this was an error, and the reason is that what the judge found here was the absence of one of the statutory mitigating circumstances, and it's acknowledged that it is a matter of state law. It's acknowledged at page 26, I think, of the state's brief that under the state's McInnes case, which the state cites, that it's not correct to make the absence of a mitigating circumstance an aggravating circumstance. So that was a finding that's a non-statutory finding. It's a finding of an aggravating circumstance that's not listed in the statute. There are two more points about that. One is that mere arrests, and again, I'm referring to Florida law, that really is a predicate for the federal arguments that I'll make later, but I'm merely trying to be descriptive. Under the Florida law, the mere arrests don't qualify as convictions, even if there's a relevant crime involved, a violent crime, under one of the other subsections. And convictions, even, can't be proved by the pre-sentence investigation report. They have to be proved by the state beyond a reasonable doubt at the penalty trial. Now turning to the next two aggravating circumstances found by the court, and these are appear in our brief at the bottom of page 33 is one, and the next one is over page 36. Both of these are equally flawed. The first one has to do with whether or not the defendant was under a sentence of imprisonment at the time of the murder. And it's undisputed that at the time of the murder, Barclay was not in prison, he was not supposed to be in prison, he was not on parole, he was not on probation, none of that. The judge found that he was not imprisoned at the top of page 34. But he said the criminal record was an aggravating circumstance. So what the judge did here, again, was to take a past criminal record and say that it was something like, it resembled the statutory aggravating circumstance. The judge did this something similar with the next one at page 36. He said that this provision is whether or not the defendant had been convicted of a felony involving use of threat of violence to the person. And there was nothing like that in Barclay's record. But the judge said that, well, he'd been convicted of breaking and entering. And the judge says, it's not known if that prior felony involved the use of threat of violence. But he said, however, such crime can and often does involve violence. So. He found something really not in terms of the statute, but he said, well, it's something like the statute. So that we have three of the findings by the court, which really aren't in terms of the statute. The judge said, well, I'm finding something that resembles the statute. Now, the fourth one is whether or not there's the murder created a great risk of death to many persons. And this one is discussed in our brief beginning over page 40. And the judge found that, in the judge's words, before, during, and after the murder, the judge said, there was a great risk of death to many persons. He based it on, he's got a before and an after, but he doesn't have a during in there. Before, he said, the defendants drove around looking for a victim. And it's undisputed that the victim was killed in a deserted, lonely road, and that there was no one else around. But the judge found that it was a great risk of death to many persons based on the fact that before finding a victim in a lonely, deserted spot, they looked at and decided not to attack people in groups in other parts of the city. It's a line of reasoning that...
Do you feel that's a totally unreasonable finding on the part of the judge?
I do, Your Honor, that there's no basis in that line of reasoning for distinguishing any case from among many cases
let me suggest my own thought that occurs to me. In a case of a premeditated murder, you could say that, you know, there was malice aforethought, et cetera, but the murderer was presumably looking only for one victim. He wasn't just going to randomly. But here one gets the impression from the judge's findings that these people were looking not for one victim, but for almost anybody they came across that met a certain description.
Well, but a single victim, and they were looking for one alone. I mean, the purpose of the statute is to protect large groups of people against death.
Well, and not...
Let me suggest there are two doctrines. One, it has to involve a lot of people. And two, under the Florida law, it has to be an actual risk of harm or death based on the nature of the murder or the conduct immediately surrounding the murder.
You feel that the Florida law wasn't designed to produce a great number of people, even though they might have been individually isolated or by themselves.
I argue on both parts. There weren't any great number of people. There was nobody around at the time of the murder, the decision not to attack a large group of people can't be considered as endangering a large group.
Mr. Nebritt, the Florida Supreme Court, though, obviously found that it, as a matter of Florida law, it met their statutory aggravating circumstance on that fourth factor.
That's correct. And our argument...
So you're not asking us to say that the Florida law is something else, are you?
My argument is that my argument is a federal constitutional one, that there's really no evidence of the offense, or the statute is construed in such a way that it's vague and overbroad. It's an argument based on the Godfrey case at bottom. But let's look at the other half of it that the judge relied on. The judge relied on something that happened 3 days after the murder, which is the mailing of tape recordings to the news media, and said this event endangered a 500,000 people of Jacksonville. The problem with that is the same one. There's nothing in the evidence. The state never tried to prove that there were any circumstances that made this dangerous, and this wasn't the state's theory. And so there's no evidence to support the notion that anyone was, in fact, endangered. Now there are three other aggravating circumstances, and our argument it's set forth in our brief at pages 48 to 63. I think I will not go through them because my time is limited, and will instead turn to the main two legal arguments.
When they came upon the victim, was the victim alone or accompanied by others?
Alone. He was a single hitchhiker alone.
Suppose there were two people there. Would it be unreasonable or irrational for the judge making the decision to think that two people would have been killed instead of one?
Well, there are several. There are several points. One is that two people even wouldn't be enough to create many people to equal many people under the Florida law. and it's set forth in our brief. So our argument really is that this is a surprise, overbroad construction of the law based on as the law has been interpreted in those Florida cases. Now, we have two principal arguments. Our first argument is that the trial court's sentencing findings violated Barclay's rights under the 8th and 14th Amendments. And the argument is, as I said before, based not merely on the notion that state law wasn't followed, but based on the idea that a combination of non-statutory aggravating circumstances and either factually baseless or overbroad construction of the Florida statute created the violation. The second argument, which I will make later, is really in the nature of a rebuttal argument. It's our answer to the state's contention that even if we are correct about the first argument, there need not be a reversal, that the error is in some way harmless or does not, at least it does not call for reversal. The main theme of the Eighth Amendment cases from Furman down to date has been that consistency and the avoidance of arbitrariness is the indispensable element to the constitutionality of capital sentencing. We think that the use of aggravating circumstances not provided in the statute violates the Eighth Amendment because it makes capital sentencing ungrounded and arbitrary. And to establish that, we point to the three main purposes that statutory aggravating circumstances were supposed to serve. The list of statutory circumstances is supposed to enable the legislature to decide what kinds of cases deserve the death penalty, so that there's a legislative judgment represented by the limited list of statutory aggravating circumstances. And if you take an example from our case of the prior criminal record, the first one the judge used, the legislature of Florida didn't decide that if someone had a prior record for a prior arrest and a prior record for forgery, that was the kind of aggravating circumstance that justified the death sentence. The second purpose, the second function of the statutory aggravating circumstances is to guide the sentencer's exercise of discretion, to channel the discretion. And the third function was to provide a basis for appellate review, so that the appellate court would have a way of looking at the findings and attempting to ensure that similar results will be reached in similar cases. And it's our position that all three of these purposes of statutory aggravating circumstances are defeated if the judge is allowed, as the judge in this case did, to make up the aggravating circumstances as he goes along. A factor that one judge will think aggravating will be evaluated differently by another. And the judge presumably will change his view as time passes so that the danger of arbitrary decision-making is reintroduced into the process.
Mr. Navid, may I ask just one question? Is it your legal position that the same, if there is one permissible aggravating circumstance that has been properly found, or are you taking the position that there are no statutory aggravating circumstances that could properly be found on this record?
But we take the latter position, Your Honor. But our argument is that there is a constitutional violation based on the fact that even if only some of them are outside the statute, that violates the Eighth Amendment. But we do take the latter position, and in our brief, Part 1A of our brief addresses each of the seven aggravating circumstances found by the judge and attempts to show that they're either outside the statute or that they're flawed under the Godfrey Doctrine.
I take it if the Florida Supreme Court agreed with your view that there were no statutory aggravating circumstances, they also would have set aside the death penalty.
That's correct. That's correct.
Mr. Neighbor, do you have any thoughts as to how the Florida system compares with Georgia's? I regard Georgia as kind of a threshold state, if I can describe it that way, so far as aggravating circumstances are concerned, and I wondered if you felt Florida was the same or was different.
No, I think it is different. I think there's nothing in the Florida decisions that uses the threshold language or the language in the recent opinion of the Georgia Supreme Court after the remand in the Zant case. So on the question of the Eighth Amendment, in summary, I guess our position is that the safeguards that the aggravating circumstances were supposed to serve under the statute fell through in this case. That the trial court really didn't live up to what was represented in Proffitt to assure that after Barclay's conviction, there really would be an informed, focused, guided, an objective inquiry into the question of whether or not he'd be sentenced to death. And I think that none of those adjectives really fairly describe the findings on which Barclay was sentenced to death, and we submit that the sentence violates the Eighth Amendment. Now, turning to the second point, which, as I said before, is a rebuttal argument, what we're doing in part two of our brief really is answering the Attorney General's contention that Florida's rule, which is embodied in its Elledge case, and which we'll call the Elledge rule, makes it appropriate for the court below to affirm, even if there were constitutional errors, even if there was a violation of the Eighth Amendment or several violations of the Eighth Amendment of the kind that we complain about in our first argument. Let me describe the Elledge rule. The Elledge case provides, really, as we see, two rules for dealing with a case where the trial court has made an error, either an error by considering a non-statutory aggravating circumstance or by misapplying one of the statutory circumstances, but where there are other valid aggravating factors remain in the case. Now, the Elledge case says that a reversal is required. That situation calls for a reversal if there are statutory mitigating findings. Because the reviewing court can't tell whether the error distorted the weighing process. So to be clear, under Florida law, it is error to consider a non-statutory aggravating circumstance. And they call it error. They call it error even in those cases where they don't reverse. And when the cases where they don't reverse are under the second half of the Elledge rule. And that is that the death sentence will be affirmed if there are no statutory mitigating circumstances. No statutory mitigating circumstances. And that's the state law premise of Elledge is in the language which is quoted at the top of page 87 of our brief. The idea is that so long as there are some statutory aggravating circumstances, there is no danger that non-statutory circumstances have served to overcome the mitigating circumstances in the weighing process. In other words, that there's nothing to balance against whatever aggravating circumstances remain, and therefore, what the Attorney General refers to in quoting the Ford case as a presumption of death, that the state quotes the same language we do from Ford, saying there being no mitigating factors present, death is presumed to be the appropriate penalty. Now, our argument is that rule itself violates the Constitution. It's a rule of appellate review, a procedural rule about when you do and when you don't reverse in the presence of a constitutional error, but that this Elledge rule violates the Constitution. Assuming that Elledge is a presumption, a rule of law, it violates Lockett. It directly violates the holding of the Lockett case because the Ohio statute in Lockett, remember, was one where if there were statutory aggravating circumstances found, and there was no statutory mitigating circumstance, then the death sentence was mandatory. That was what that statute did. And the Ehrlich case is identical in the way it ignores the non-statutory mitigating factors. And the Ford case, which I mentioned before, the Ford case in the Florida Supreme Court, makes it plain that that's the way the Ehrlich rule operates, because it shows that the Ehrlich rule operates even if there are non-statutory mitigating circumstances in the record, that there's a presumption of death, so that the presumption overrides non-statutory mitigating circumstances, just like that Ohio statute in the Lockett case did. The second, we really have four objections to the Ehrlich rule, and the first one I've just mentioned, which is based on Lockett. The second one is that the penalty is automatic without regard to the sufficiency of the aggravating circumstances. It's just a mechanical rule, and that violates Woodson and Lockett, which require there be a judgment about the appropriateness of the death penalty. The final two points I'll touch on quickly, and they're familiar to the Court. Assuming that Ehrlich is not really strictly a mechanical rule, and does involve some judgment or some guess as to what the trial court would have done in the circumstances, then we have the Stromberg principle, which is the same argument that's before the Court in the Exam versus Stevens. And we also have our general Eighth Amendment argument that kind of review doesn't meet the special Eighth Amendment requirements of reliability, which are required because of the special harshness of the death penalty. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Before you sit down, do you have any special comment about Lewis against the state?
Well, Your Honor, we...
The reason I ask you this is that your opponent doesn't cite it at all, and you cite it profusely from his brief. It is as though it doesn't exist.
Well, that's right. If the Lewis case, we make the argument about the Lewis case, Your Honor, in our brief in part 2A or part 2B, and our argument is that if Lewis is the Florida law, then Lewis was reversed. It was a case from the same judge. If that's the Florida law, then there's no non-arbitrary application of Ehrlich that could rule against Barclay. So the key factor in Lewis was the jury recommendation of life. And then Lewis says that where the jury recommends life, then that counts as if it was a finding of a mitigating factor. Lewis is ignored in some of the other cases. But if Lewis is the law, then Barclay claims should win.
And maybe he'll explain why he hasn't cited it.
Mr. Albritton.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, the state of Florida has never claimed that defendants in her courts receive a perfect trial, but only a fair one. And as of this date, at approximately 1:35 p.m., that's all the Constitution requires. I think because of the multiplicity of challenges hurled at cases affirming the death penalty, it would seem that the only time a capital defendant receives a fair trial is when he is acquitted. I think the overriding issue before this Court is whether the imposition of the death penalty in the instant case contravenes any of the protections afforded by the petitioner or to him under the Constitution, not only the federal but the state. A good starting place is the standard of review followed by the Florida Supreme Court in its review of death penalty cases. That court assumes, and logically so, that where there are multiple statutory aggravating factors and there are no mitigating factors at all, then the weighing process would have reached the same outcome by the trial judge, even had he not considered what is termed an improper aggravating factor. Now, this principle is well illustrated in several cases, and I'll mention only two of them. One is Doebert v. State, where the Florida Supreme Court held that the trial judge improperly found two aggravating factors. But since there were no mitigating factors at all, a reversal of the death sentence was not required. And in Ford v. State, cited on page 15 of my brief, the same result was reached by the Florida Supreme Court. And what is interesting about both of those cases is that this court declined to review either one of them on certiorari. I have no hesitancy to urge to this court that petitioner's death penalty was properly imposed based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt of what I count as five statutory aggravating factors and no mitigating factors at all. In thinking about this, I want it to be understood that in finding this non-statutory aggravating factor that is now complained of to the court, the trial judge did not consider any evidence that he would not have otherwise known. Rather, it was necessary for the trial judge to consider petitioner's prior criminal record because unless the existence of this mitigating factor is negated, then there would be a presumption that petitioner had not engaged in any previous course of crime at all. This is, again, well illustrated in the Florida Supreme Court case of Booker v. State, where that court rejected now an argument that the trial judge had considered a non-statutory aggravating factor because on cross-examination, the defendant was interrogated as to his prior criminal activity. Now, the Florida Supreme Court pointedly stated that those questions were posed to the defendant in order to negate or show the absence of a mitigating circumstance. That is, that the defendant had no significant history of prior criminal actions. Now, this was not necessary, as the court pointed out, and I quote the words of the court, unless this mitigating factor is negated, there would be a presumption that the defendant had not engaged in any previous criminal activity, unquote. Therefore, I say to you that in finding a non-statutory aggravating factor, the trial judge not only did not review any evidence that he was not entitled to do so, rather he was required to review that evidence in order to determine the existence of the non-existence of a mitigating factor.
Mr. Albritton, do you plan to address the Lewis case, as Justice Blackmun inquired about, which appeared to hold that if a jury found that the defendant should be sentenced to life, that was treated as a mitigating circumstance then and required a different action when it was challenged by the defendant?
Only to the extent that I don't believe in the Lewis case that the Florida Supreme Court so held. I don't read the case that way at all. But if we assume that they did so hold, then I say in the instant case, it has to be obvious that this mitigating factor, that is, the advisory verdict of the jury, was completely overweighed by the multiple statutory aggravating factors that were found by the trial judge and twice approved by the Florida Supreme Court. Now, I submit to you that unless this court does a legal about-face in Profit v. Florida, that that case should control the instant case here. The Profit opinion, 428 U.S., page 246, sets forth the aggravating factors found by the trial judge. Now, the second of those reads, and I quote, "The petitioner has a propensity to commit murder," unquote. Now, I find this interesting because this aggravating factor of propensity to commit murder was not then and never has been a statutorily enumerated aggravating factor under Florida law. I think, frankly, there is no getting around the point that this court approved the use of a non-statutory aggravating factor when used now, along with other statutory aggravating factors. The decision in Elledge v. State supports the respondent's argument here, because the Elledge court, in construing Profit, read something in there, I believe, that is not there. But rather than to go into that, let's take Elledge the way it stands. And Elledge simply holds that a non-statutory aggravating factor will not vitiate a death penalty where there are other statutorily enumerated factors and there are no mitigating factors. That is the holding in Elledge. I'd like to tell you how they came to do that. From the record in Elledge, there was a non-statutory enumerated aggravating factor. And, of course, there was a statutory aggravating factor, and that the trial judge had alluded to something that could have been construed as being a mitigating factor. Well, now, what the Florida Supreme Court wanted to do, and what they did do, was to be sure that a non-statutory aggravating factor would not be used to offset a mitigating factor in the weighing process. But we don't have that problem here because there were no mitigating factors at all, unless you do, as my honorable opponent would urge you to do, and that is substitute your judgment and reweigh all of the aggravating factors that were weighed by the trial judge and approved by the Florida Supreme Court. If you do that, then you will depart from the decision in Eddings v. Oklahoma.
Well, but isn't there another possibility? Because I thought when you answered Justice O'Connor, you said that it's possible to read the Lewis case, I guess it is, as saying that when the jury recommends life sentence rather than death, that that may be viewed as a mitigating circumstance which imposes a burden on being sure that the aggravating outweigh. Now, how do you explain Lewis if you
Maybe. Maybe. That's true. It may be, but the Florida Supreme Court does not undertake to dictate to the trial judge what he shall regard as mitigating evidence. That's a matter for the sentencing authority to do, not for the Florida Supreme Court.
But then how do you explain Lewis?
Just the way I did to Justice O'Connor, that I don't believe and I don't read the case.
You said to her, if I recall, that may mean that the aggravating outweighed that mitigating circumstance. But then you've just now told us that you can't engage in weighing when there are some non-statutory aggravating circumstances. I'm not sure your arguments are consistent.
I'm not sure I understand you, and I submit to you, sir, I'm not sure you understood what I said. You may have, I don't know, but if I said that, I did not mean to say it.
May I ask you again then?
Sure.
How do you explain Lewis?
Lewis, as I understand it, there is language in it which would indicate that a jury advisory can be viewed, if the trial judge so desires, as a mitigating factor. However, the verdict of the jury, it isn't really a verdict, it's an advisory. It isn't binding on the trial judge at all. And if he so desires, in view of the other evidence, you can read Lewis as saying that he can use that as a mitigating factor. But I don't think the Florida Supreme Court has required him to do that. I don't read the case that way.
It's entirely a matter within the discretion of the trial judge whether or not to view it as a mitigating factor under your submission.
That's correct, because he is the sentencing authority under Florida law. He is the one that does the weighing under Florida law. The Florida Supreme Court simply on review looks at the evidence and determines if it is competent to support the aggravating factors that the trial judge has found. They do that. In fact, the duty is well stated in Songer v. State, which this court referred to in Profit v. Florida, and I quote, "Where the death penalty has been imposed, this court has a separate responsibility to determine independently whether the imposition of the ultimate penalty is warranted," unquote. And that's what they do. They don't reweigh in the sense, if you please, to determine if the death penalty is or should be initially imposed. But what they do on review is to determine if it has been lawfully imposed, if there is competent evidence cited by the trial judge in support of his findings. I think, too, that the Florida Supreme Court standard of review in death penalty cases can be reviewed actually for what it is, and that is the application of the harmless error rule. Now, there's nothing new in this, because more than 30 years ago in North v. State, decided in 1952, the Florida Supreme Court expressly held that the harmless error rule was applicable in capital cases. And not only that, in the two Ferguson cases, which I cite in my brief, the application of the harmless error rule is clear. For example, in Ferguson 417 Southern 2nd 631, the court held that, and I quote, "Any error that occurred in the consideration of the inapplicable aggravating circumstances was harmless," unquote. And again, in Ferguson 417 639, the court held that any error that occurred in the consideration of the two inapplicable aggravating factors was harmless, based on the weighing process that the judge followed. And interestingly, in the recent case of Ford v. Strickland, 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in bank opinion filed January 7, 1983, Chief Judge Godbold, in a dissenting opinion in part and specially concurring in part, stated that he interpreted the Florida Supreme Court to apply a harmless error rule in refusing to order resentencing, and that the Florida Supreme Court's actions so interpreted passed constitutional muster. This court, several justices, I think, have opted for the application of the harmless error rule. In Zant v. Stevens, Justice Powell in a dissenting opinion, stated he would leave it open to the Georgia Supreme Court to decide whether it had authority to find that the instruction complained of was harmless error. In Drake v. Zant, Justice White, dissenting to a denial of cert, stated that as a matter of general constitutional policy, he thought it essential that appellate courts be able to employ a harmless error rule. In fact, this court has employed the harmless error rule in several cases. Schnebel v. State, Milton v. Wainwright, Harrington v. California, and in the well-known Chapman case. Now then, looking at petitioner's brief, the tenor of it is, of course, that the trial judge committed egregious error in failing to find any mitigating factor at all. Well, really, this is understandable when viewed from where he sits. However, this claim has been made and rejected by the Florida Supreme Court in many cases. They are cited in my brief, Lucas v. State, Siriki v. State, McInnes v. State. And in that case, it's a good case on point. It says the court there, let me phrase this properly, rejected the argument that certain testimony should have been treated as mitigating factor. There was psychiatric or testimony at trial, and it was argued that the trial judge erred in refusing to regard that as mitigating. Well, the Florida Supreme Court pointed out that the testimony was apparently permitted by the trial judge in an abundance of fairness to the defendant, but that the court was not required to give it weight as a mitigating circumstance. Now, they leave the weighing, initial weighing, to the trial judge. This premise, I think, is supported, well supported by this court's decision in Eddings v. Oklahoma. There, this court reviewed the Oklahoma death penalty statute, which permitted a defendant to present evidence as to any mitigating factor that he so desired, and then stated that Lockett v. Ohio requires the sentencer to listen, but as to the weight to be given to the mitigating evidence, I quote the words of the court, we do not weigh the evidence for them. And in this connection, it must be pointed out that Lockett held that while the sentencing authority must not be precluded from reviewing anything offered as mitigating, it did not undertake to dictate the weight that the various factors are to be given by the trial court. And that Lockett v. Ohio does not indicate that this court would substitute its judgment for that of state courts in capital cases at all.
Mr. Albritton, would you characterize the Florida scheme as a threshold scheme like that of Georgia or a balancing scheme? It wasn't clear to me from your brief.
It's both. Your Honor, the significance of the aggravating factor at the threshold of the process is to determine if the death penalty may be imposed, if it can be imposed. And if there's one or more, then the judge knows that it can be imposed. But thereafter, then there is a weighing process, weighing the aggravating against the mitigating. That's where the weighing comes in for him to find out or make up his mind if he should impose the death penalty.
Under the Florida scheme, if the trial judge found no mitigating circumstances and found one or more aggravating circumstances, is the trial judge required to impose the death penalty?
Oh, no. No, he isn't.
So he just balances all the facts in your scheme?
No, absolutely, he is not. There is no requirement that he impose it at all. He might find five aggravating factors and no mitigating factors.
But if he finds some aggravating factors, he may impose the death penalty, even though some of his aggravating factors may be set aside on appeal.
As long as there are no mitigating.
Right, right.
But under the Elledge case, the Supreme Court will not permit, Justice Wawite, a non-statutory aggravating factor to offset any mitigating factor in the weighing process. That's the point.
Assuming no mitigating factors at all, in Florida, I take it your submission is that the judge may consider in deciding whether to impose the death penalty statutory as well as non-statutory mitigating circumstances.
No, sir, that was an error. Well, it would be an error now. You see, Justice White, at the time of petitioner's trial, in February, March 1975, non-statutory aggravating factors had not been withdrawn from use by the Florida Supreme Court.
Well,
that was not done until 2 years afterward when the court decided the law,
the law of Florida at the time of this sentence was that the judge could use non-statutory circumstances.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. That was the law, absolutely.
So we should judge this case as though it still was the law, is that it?
Can if you want to, but if you apply the law as it is now, you're still going to come to the same conclusion.
And because of harmless error or what?
Harmless error, absolutely.
Well, that isn't the... Is that the basis for the judgment below?
It's been referred to as a harmless error, yes. And I don't see any other reason to call it anything but that. They use... words to the effect that where there are multiple aggravating and no mitigating.
What's the purpose of withdrawing the use of non-statutory aggravating circumstances as factors? Then, would it always be harmless error?
Not under all cases. No, there's one case. I'm sorry to say.
Well, how do you know this one is one of them?
Beg pardon?
How would you know that this one is one of them if you applied the current Florida law?
Because there was no mitigating factors to be offset non-statutory aggravating factor.
Lewis required that the jury recommendation be considered as a mitigating factor.
Let's assume you do that it requires that. If the aggravating, non-statutory aggravating factor offsets that, or you still have five statutorily enumerated aggravating factors proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And that hasn't been, it has, too. He argues that it isn't. He wants you to substitute your judgment for that of the state trial judge. Sir?
Didn't Prophet say that the judge had to use, quote, informed, focused, guided, and objective inquiry?
That's what he does, yes, sir.
Do you know what he said?
Yes, sir.
Now, where can you get harmless error?
Well, because harmless error is used in everything. If you're going to take out the harmless error.
If you want to be objective, how can you make a harmless error?
Justice, Marshall, if you take out harmless error, you're requiring the trial to be perfect, and none of them are. There isn't anything in the realm of human affairs that is without some error somewhere. We can't give a man a perfect trial. He can't get one anywhere else. Nowhere. But we can come as close to it as humanly possible.
And if you don't make it, it's harmless.
Yes, sir. It certainly is. It's harmless. I want to, my time is about up. I had other things to say, but they'll go by the board.
Well, you have about 3 minutes left.
Yes, sir. I'm aware of the holdings in Stromberg v. California, Yates v. United States, Street v. New York, and the other cases. Those were First Amendment cases involving a general verdict of guilt. However, I agree with Justice White when he stated in dissenting opinion in Drake v. Zant that the imposition of the death sentence, despite a failure to sustain all of the aggravating factors found by the jury, does not conflict with either Stromberg v. California or Street v. New York.
You're rowing upstream. That was just
I know
dissent.
I got a good paddle, though. Judge, I want to conclude on this point.
Pretty good response.
It seems to me, and I know this is policy or politics or whatever, but it seems to me, and it seems to us down there in that little state of Florida, that at some point it must be acknowledged that the seemingly never-ending procedural path of capital cases does more to undermine the criminal justice system and society's confidence in it than it does to protect the rights of those who have killed fellow human beings. Hopefully, and I say this hopefully, that we can re-echo the statement found in Stein v. New York to apply to the state of Florida that the people down there in that state are entitled to some measure of due process just as much as a murdering defendant is entitled to it. Thank you.
You have anything further, Mr. Neybert?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court, in the few moments I have left, I'd like to talk about how I see the harmless error concept coming into this case and also say something about the Lewis case. I think a factual point to be made about how Lewis fits in here is that there were facts upon which the jury might reasonably have found that there were both statutory and non-statutory mitigating circumstances for Barkley. The argument of counsel was based on the record that he was a follower. He was not the leader of the group of people who were convicted of the murder. His family status, that he had a wife and five children, that he had a job, that he was a young man, only 23 years old. And a major fact that was emphasized to the jury was the disparity of sentencing, the disparity of punishment between Barkley and the other two people who got second-degree murder, but who the jury knew had committed two murders, but were sentenced to terms of imprisonment. And the jury also might very well have based its finding on either of four of the statutory mitigating factors: the age, the fact that the state did not prove the prior record. They might have found lesser participation, and they may have found domination by Dugan. Now, it seems to me that the state's distinction of Lewis is not correct. Lewis is an application of the Elledge rule. It's an appellate level rule and not a trial level rule. In the Lewis case was sent back for resentencing. The same judge and same counsel representing the state, Mr. Albert Nargut and Judge Olive, decided Lewis. And he made the same kinds of errors he did here. And the Court of Appeals reversed Lewis because there three of the same kinds of aggravating circumstances were reversed. And the ground for a remand in Lewis was merely that there was a jury, that the remaining aggravating circumstance had to be weighed against the jury's life recommendation. Now, turning to the harmless error point, this is not really a harmless error case in the ordinary sense, in the Chapman sense. There's no submission by the state, there's no inquiry by the state into the question of prejudice. Certainly the court below didn't rely on harmless error. They didn't acknowledge that there was any error at all. So whether you call it the Elledge rule or harmless error, it's really the same thing. It's harmless error principles attempted to be used in justification for a presumption, a legal rule, the Elledge rule. And our four objections to the Elledge rule, I think, pertain whether you call it harmless error or not. The counsel did not, in argument and in his brief, disagree with our characterization of Elledge as ignoring, Elledge and Ford, ignoring non-statutory mitigating circumstances. And the only exception to that is Lewis. But is the Lewis case. Lewis is the law, as I said before. There's no non-arbitrary application of the law to that would convict Barclay. But even examining this case under, if we ever got to trying to apply the Chapman v. California doctrine to this case, considering the special care and reliability required in capital sentencing, the fact that the death sentence was by no means foreordained in this case. There's no way that you can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error, the multiple constitutional errors we submit that were the basis of the sentence of Elwood Barclay could be harmless. My time has expired.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.